And I get to hear them today, for real. Okay, we're going to move into a bit of a reading, which you're going to get to participate in. Some of you may remember Prairie Home Companion back when Harrison Keeler was still with it. I'm not sure that they still have cowboy poetry and Rusty and Lefty on Prairie Home. I haven't been listening more recently, but some of you may remember that the cowboy setting is sometimes appropriate. I'm going to ask Dave to start off with a little bit. You know how it goes, right? Okay, now we need some clip clots. Keep going, Dave. Let me ask this row closest to the piano, do some. Good, keep it going. Okay, now we need some horsies, some whinnying. Any of you remember? Let's hear some whinnying. Think Frau Blücher. Okay. Now we need some moos. Let's hear some moos. Keep going. Now some of you deep men's voices, we need some sheep, so do that. Quite fine. Okay, I'm going to have a little reading, and then after the reading, I will cue you, and we will do sort of a coda to this whole thing. So here's our cowboy poetry for today. What does resurrection mean? A cowpoke asked his friend. His pal replied, it happens when your life has reached its end. They comb your hair and wash your neck and clean your fingernails and lay you in a padded box away from life's travails. The box and you goes in a hole that's dug into the ground. Reincarnation starts when you're planted neath a mound. Them clods melt down just like your box and you who is inside, and then you're just beginning on your transformation ride. In a while, the grass will grow upon your rendered mound, till someday on your moldered grave a lovely flower is found. And if a horse should wander by and graze upon this flower that once was you, but now has become your vegetative bower, the posy that the horse done ate up with his other feed makes bone and fat and muscle essential to the steed. But some is left that he can't use, and so it passes through and finally lays upon the ground this thing that once was you. Then if by chance I wanders by and sees this on the ground, I ponder and I wander at this object that I found. I think of reincarnation, of life and death and such, and I come away concluding, Slim, you ain't changed all that much. All right, let's have some sounds on that. Okay, I think that's quite enough. Maybe I should say to those who are audio streaming this service, and who, at least those who haven't logged off yet, who may be wondering, is he always this strange? Well, I see a quorum of nods. Salvation, reincarnation, we don't hear those words around UU congregations much. And yet for over 12 centuries, people in the ancient world knew all about salvation and where to find it. Getting there required long journeys, more often than not. Where was the spot? Delphi, a cluster of buildings on the southern slope of Mount Parnassus in central Greece. Some of you been to Delphi? Yeah, a couple of dozen, sure. A woman of Delphi was chosen as the oracle, the voice of salvation, and she offered cryptic consultations from the gods on any and all subjects, ranging from family matters to choosing sides in times of war. This woman was the highest authority, both civil and religious, in male-dominated ancient Greece. She responded to questions of citizens, foreigners, kings, philosophers. questions on issues of politics, war, duty, crime, personal issues. She was the Ann Landers of the day. The Oracle sat on a three-legged stool in the interior chamber of the Temple of Apollo, where she delivered her prosaic wisdom. King Croesus of Lydia once traveled to Delphi to consult the Oracle before deciding whether or not to attack Persia. The Oracle replied, "If you cross the river, a great empire will be destroyed." Believing this response was positive, Croesus attacked. A great empire was destroyed, his own. What was the Oracle's secret source of her wisdom? Well, geology has the answer. She inhaled. And what did she inhale? Delphi's location was strategically chosen on the slope of Mount Parnassus, not because of the view, but because of a sound scientific reason. At Delphi, the underlying bedrock is a bituminous limestone full of coal, and it's cut by two intersecting faults, the Delphi Fault and the Kerna Fault, and these two faults intersect directly under the Temple of Apollo. And as a result, the underlying bedrock is highly fractured, it's permeable. Groundwaters can percolate through this fractured rock. And above this fractured rock, in the temple, the women delivered their oracles of salvation. They inhaled the breath of the gods that was emanating from the groundwaters bubbling up out of the Cocytus spring, which is directly under the temple and which carries sweet-smelling fumes, specifically ethylene, ethane, and methane. Ethylene is a sweet-smelling gas, and it would have had the strongest effect. There's a recent issue of Clinical Toxicology which says, the effects from ethylene are nearly immediate. The dose needed for an awake, euphoric feeling is significantly less than that which is needed for deep operational anesthesia. And that's what the oracles at Delphi discovered long ago. The women delivered their euphoric wisdom, and they did so, note this, they did so only three seasons of the year. They didn't work in winter. I guess they went to Miami. They didn't work in winter because when the ground froze and the groundwater quit bubbling, then the vapors quit. So they had 3 months off, and they resumed in the spring. Well, today it is late afternoon in Delphi. What is it, about 5:30 or so? Despite the dismal economy in Greece, hundreds of tourists are schlepping their way back to the tour buses, going through the gift shops, maybe picking up some little souvenir flasks of ethylene vapors that they can take back to Peoria and inhale. I don't know what they sell there. I'm not sure if these little flasks would make it through airport security at Athens. Let's see. Actually, suppose you and I were to nominate who would be the modern day equivalent of the Delphic Oracle. Is there such a focus? I'd be interested in your comments as we have breakfast in a little while. Recently, I was chatting with a ministerial colleague who was going through this season's cycle of chatting with search committees, and she had received a very positive vote from the congregation, and she suggested that, thinking of the Delphic oracles, that maybe Spider-Woman or Spider-Man would be the prototype of highly desired salvation qualities and wisdom qualities. Someone who can leap over tall obstacles, spin complex webs, move at superhuman speeds, and fight the forces of evil. A bearer of congregational salvation, in one respect. Spider-Woman. So why is salvation a word that we almost never hear among you use?
think for very good reason. We've inherited a misleading notion that salvation is a separate department of life, far away, mostly unattainable place or condition, a Shangri-La, a delusion of fantasy, a silly distraction from the pragmatic business of getting through the day. Too often salvation is equated with resuscitation of the dead, or even a reincarnation after death, as represented in this little bit of cowboy poetry. But I would argue that salvation, properly understood, is not about someplace else or later on, close to home, and it's right now. It's accessible. Salvation is a vital awareness, staying alert, paying attention. You know, we might have to just give up that word salvation altogether if it gets in the way. If it misdirects our focus towards someplace else or sometime else. But by whatever name you might choose, the intention is listen to your life. Pay attention. See it for the fathomless mystery that it is. Listen more deeply, more attentively. Now perhaps, let's try an example. Perhaps you've heard a friend say something like this. You know, I just really come alive when I listen to a Beethoven string quartet. Or I truly come alive when I'm working in my garden. Wherever and whenever you most fully come alive, touching and tasting and smelling and inhaling more deeply, that experience is a form of salvation. So don't be misled by the word. Don't miss the experience. Salvation is a radical choice of the human heart, a radical decision to move out of places of deadness and stagnation and whining and and self-pity and having pity parties, and become more fully alive. You know, over the last, 15 years I've been a transition consultant. This has focused my own notions of salvation. I call it salvation by deadline. And again, don't be misled. By deadline, I don't mean anxious, driven focus on results and getting it done. It's actually quite the opposite. For me, salvation by deadline is a humble recognition that life is precious and limited. This notion appears every time I meet with a family to prepare a memorial service, when our shared mortality is front and center. And this shared mortality sweeps across my desk and my calendar and my little sticky notes and sweeps them all away and says, I'll get back to you, but right now you pay attention to me. Right now you pay attention to me. Pay attention not so much to the teeny tiny little idols that I have created and think are just oh so serious, but pay attention to the passing of time, the gift of time. An acute sense of mortality, says Andrew Harvey, combined with the poignancy of time passing, this is what breeds a love for all things. I want to turn back the clock exactly 35 years. 35 years, spring of 1982. Diane and I were in a class of seventh graders at the Unitarian Church in Barnstable, Mass. And one Sunday we offered a little thought experiment. Here was our thought experiment for these seventh graders. Suppose that right now you could know for sure that you're going to live forever. Suppose that right now you knew this was true. You shall live forever. What will you do next? And for several minutes, the kids puzzled, and we were quiet. And then I watched what happened. And it was remarkable. The kids did not jump around joyfully, whoopee, as if they were liberated. On the contrary, they turned into zombies, stumbling, mumbling, incoherently in a timeless, boundaryless blather. And these kids had discovered the secret and the meaning of life without maybe realizing. If life had no boundaries, no closures, we become like zombies. Because without death, without deadlines and closures, nothing really matters much. Whatever. Life becomes an indifferent shrug. If we had all the time in the world, then what we choose would not matter. In Homer's Odyssey, let's go back to Greece. In Homer's Odyssey, the sea goddess Calypso is envious of Odysseus and the other humans. Why? Precisely because they are mortal. Every choice becomes a courageous act of ruling out many things that will never be done. And it is in those deadlines and closures where lies meaning and salvation. You know, the discipline and deadlines of sermon preparation each week for the past 30 years off and on, these are essential in my health and well-being. Deadlines save me from trying to, if only I had a little more time. No, this is it. Got to go with what you got. That is a hugely helpful discipline to keep from just, I got to get it right. And the paralysis that comes with keeping my options open forever and ever and ever. Salvation by deadline. For me, it's like a mother bird that teaches my fledgling desires to flap their little wings. I'm kind of knocking them out of the nest. There's a final virtue to salvation by deadline. It saves me not only from procrastination and paralysis, but also from perfection. Yes, with more time, I might have done better, and I might not. No matter. The time comes for each of us to do or to die. And so we did, and we lived. And whatever the results, the reviews, the tally, we're done. It is finished, or now. Left to our own devices, we might probably never finish. We would be like young children who just will not go to bed. But the curtain comes down, and our eyelids close, and we are borne aloft and at last on eagle's wings to our rest. How to close. How to wrap up my brief sojourn with you. Here on Ironbound Road, what might I choose as a final word? Well, a story, of course. And as a Kansan, where the history of life and creation and science and all that pops its head out every once in a while, I want to offer another creation story. Not a once upon a time event so much, but it's also about salvation in a way. It's about how you and I might engage this wonderful life more fully. This is a story which I've adapted from T.H. White's novel, The Once and Future King. The story is told by the badger. I like to think this badger is from Madison, Wisconsin. It's a creation story, not about a one-time only event, but the creative possibilities that are ours right now. Once upon a time, long, long ago, the badger relates, God created many different forms of life. But rather than each of these creatures being fully developed, they remained only a set of very primitive, vulnerable embryos. They were primitive little critters. And they all looked very much alike, as embryos do. They didn't yet have any of the particular features that would be required for survival as adults and specialization. But in this raw, vulnerable condition, God decides to give each of these beings a choice. She summons all the embryos into her presence and offers them any specialization which they desire as they mature into their adult forms. And so one by one, each of the embryos choose what they hope might be their most advantageous qualities. Some choose sharp claws, some choose sharp eyesight, others the ability to fly, others a warm insulated coat, and so forth. And finally, last of all, the human embryo approaches God. "If you please," says the human embryo, "I can only imagine that I already have those particular shapes and gifts and capacities for reasons that are far beyond me to understand. And I think it would be rather rude to ask for a change. And so, if I am to have a choice, then I shall choose to stay just as I am. I will not alter any of the parts which you have given to me. I may stay rather defenseless all my life, just doing my best to make for myself a few feeble implements out of the world that is around me, the wood and iron and other materials which you have seen fit to put before me." So says the human embryo. And then exclaimed the Creator, "Well done. Hey, come over here, all you other embryos. Come here with your beaks and claws and long necks and muscles and whatnots. Come here and look at our first human being. This is the only one who has guessed the riddle of this life. As for you, O woman and man, you will remain eternally incomplete, eternally undeveloped. You will always remain potential in our image. You will be able to see some of the eternal sorrows and to feel some of the eternal joys. We are partly sorry for you and sad, and yet we are also hopeful. We are very hopeful. So run along then and do your best. Run along then. Do your best." Please join me in the congregational affirmation, which is printed in your order of service. This is adapted from Denise Levertov. "As swimmers dare to lie face to the sky and water bears them, as hawks rest upon air and air sustains them, so will I learn to obtain free fall and know these creator spirits. Once upon a time, nearly 30 years ago, several dozen charter members of this congregation gathered and promised to walk together. And since then, their commitments, resources, and dedication have borne fruit and are now entrusted to us. Let me invite Les and Lola to join me up front. Our opportunity has been to carry forward their trust in living shared values and restoring worth and dignity to our world. It has been my privilege to serve as your interim minister for the past two eventful years. Now the time has come to bring closure to our time together.